Hello, this is David Brim, and I'm the founder of Orlando Entrepreneurs. We are the hub for Orlando entrepreneurship, and our mission is to connect, cultivate, and celebrate our local entrepreneurs. We bring together our local entrepreneurial ecosystem to help impact our entrepreneurs, their companies, and our local economy. Learn more at OrlandoEntrepreneurs.org. Now over to Josh Wilson to get forward with our show.
Good day, fellow entrepreneurs here in Orlando and elsewhere. Welcome to the Orlando Entrepreneur Show. My name is Josh, I'm the podcast host, and I travel around Orlando and I speak with the founders here in Orlando, building great businesses, investing in businesses, and really believing in the community here in Orlando to do this. So on today's show, this is a really exciting thing because I'm with our founder, David Brim, and we're interviewing together, having a conversation with Ted Murphy, the CEO of IZEA. Ted, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Yeah. So as we gather in this room together, you have a really incredible office. As we're walking through, just it looks like the culture here, the environment here is incredibly welcoming, very cool. Can you explain to us what IZEA is and how you started this?
Yeah, so IZEA is a company that builds technology that connects marketers with creators. And those creators range from YouTubers, bloggers, Twitter users, Instagrammers, basically anybody who is creating content or is influential online. And we facilitate the transactions that happen between brands who are looking to have content produced and have content distributed with those individuals. And our mission is really focused on those individuals and being a champion of the creator and helping them to earn, you know, hopefully a living, if not maybe just supplement their income and allow them to have some money to put towards whatever their passions are.
I really like this, the champion of the creator. Yeah. Right, there's content creators out there who are devoting their life to their art, to their niche, to their mission, and you guys are their champions to help them.
I mean, we really believe that is our mission, is to help them make money, to help them be able to fuel their passion, whatever that passion may be. And that comes in all different forms. You know, some of that is cash. Actually, most of that is cash, but we also get them to have, you know, fantastic trips and experiences and products. You know, it's a pretty rewarding place for us to be as a company.
Awesome. So before I go into more details of the company, let's go into more details of Ted. Who is Ted as a person? Before we hit the record button, we were talking about running.
Wait, should I lay down on a couch?
Do you have a couch in here?
No. Okay. No. Not in this room anyway.
Awesome. So tell us a little bit about Ted. You know, like, how did you come up with this idea? Talk to us about your entrepreneurial journey.
Yeah, I was born into a family of entrepreneurs. My dad, you know, growing up was... he had everything from radio stations to furniture companies to video production companies. He took two companies public in the 80s. And so that was really all I ever knew, was kind of the entrepreneurial lifestyle and journey. And I say that recognizing that, like, it's the good and the bad of that, right? You know, we had some incredibly awesome years and decades, and I've also seen everything crumble and fall apart. You know, for me, there was never really a question of what I was going to be when I grew up. I knew I was going to be an entrepreneur. I just didn't know exactly what I would be doing. You know, I started my first company when I was in high school, and I would sell T-shirts to my classmates. And at the time, I didn't have enough money to actually print the T-shirts in advance, so I would go around, I'd walk around with my concept art, and I would get people to basically prepay for everything, and then once I had enough money, I would have them produced. I've always been in businesses that had to do with creativity or marketing, and then I've always been just fascinated with technology. My dad bought a Mac in 1984, and I think that the biggest gift that he ever gave me was he just let me play with it whenever I wanted to, you know. And I was I wasn't even 10 years old yet. And that addiction, that excitement of being able to work on a computer, all the stuff, even when I was doing the t-shirts, all the art was done on a computer. And that's just been something that has, continued throughout my professional career, is that it's, bringing the creative aspects together with technology, and then, creating different types of companies that that bring those two aspects together.
So if I wanted to go back in time and buy one of these shirts from you, like, what did these shirts look like? Your first concepts, the first art that you launched in this world, what did they look like?
Oh, man. A lot of that stuff was inspired. My sister had just gone to college, and I started seeing a lot of what the college kids, and specifically the kids that were in the fraternities, were wearing. And so those provided a lot of the inspiration, and also got me in a lot of trouble in high school.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because a lot of it was, having to do with alcohol and, just
high school kid stuff.
High school kid stuff, you know? And it was just like, as a high school kid, it was like, oh my gosh, this is really cool. But the teachers and the principals,
they didn't
really appreciate that.
Okay, so we won't go try to promote any of your old t-shirts here. So from selling t-shirts and slinging t-shirts and playing on the first release of these Macs, and really starting to develop this niche of becoming an entrepreneur, but also mixed with creativity. Talk to us about, how did you launch into new businesses? Through your education or after that?
Yeah,
what did that look like?
After I graduated from high school, I went on to college. I went to school at FSU. One of the first things I did there was I tried to create, I saw a need. A lot of the kids were trying to figure out what to do, what parties to go to, what bars to go to. Even though I was 17 years old, and I couldn't get into any of those bars, I was like, oh, that's what people are really tuned into. I created a platform that was all driven by a computer that would basically allow people to call up and figure out what was the entertainment that night, what were the bar specials that night. But it turned out that I couldn't sell it to anybody because nobody would take me seriously. I couldn't even go into a lot of these places. So that failed miserably, even though the technology worked. I got a job at the local, it was like the school newspaper, but it was independent. It was independently run. It wasn't run by the university. And together with another person there, who wound up becoming a partner of mine in the next business, we started doing some side work where we would develop things for local businesses, the fraternities and the other organizations on campus, the school sports teams, and that quickly became a bigger revenue source than what was being generated on the ad side of the newspaper. And he and I kind of looked at each other and were like, we should just kind of do this together. That's what we decided to do. So we had, it was just he and I when we first started. I completely maxed out my credit card. We were able to buy one computer and one printer, and he would work during the day and I would work during the night. And that was our thing. And we set it up inside. He lived at the inside the fraternity house at that time, and we were both part of the same fraternity, and it was just all out of the fraternity dorm room, whatever, fraternity house room. And we grew that up over time, and after 5 years, I think, I decided that I wanted to part ways and focus on this thing that they call the internet. And so I sold out my part of the business and then started another company here in Orlando, started my first company here in Orlando.
Nice. And what was that? So you went to FSU, had an office inside of a fraternity house. So maybe not the best place for
that. That was the first office. You know, it's funny. It's like we started inside a fraternity house. We then moved to a garage. Yeah. We rented a house and moved into a garage. That was a huge step up for us. And then at that point, I think we had like 4 people working for us. And then eventually moved into like a proper office. Right. So we progressed pretty quickly, but yeah, that fraternity house, like people would be running down the halls and it would be parties going on and people would come by and I would, you know, because I worked at during the night, people were looking at me and I'm like sitting in my room working and they're outside doing shots and it's just like crazy.
Yeah, absolutely. So then you moved to Orlando.
Yep.
And I always like to highlight, and this is for, you know, this is Josh speaking to the audience, and just one reason I like to hear people's stories because it helps form the pathway for other entrepreneurs because they could hear your story, your successes, maybe some failures, and it could help give them inspiration and education. So if people are thinking of building a business or growing their own business, they could go, oh, this worked for Ted or it didn't work for Ted. Maybe it won't or will work for us. So. Yep. So you moved here to Orlando. Why'd you pick Orlando, and what did you build here?
The girl I was dating at the time. You know, her parents lived in Flagler Beach. My parents lived on Marco Island. This was kind of halfway in between the two. It had a great international airport, so you could get to the places that you needed to be, and it was kind of the closest thing to a metropolitan area, you know, at that time that we saw, like there was something going on here.
Sure.
And even then it was like, it was clear to me that there was something that was happening here, but I couldn't quite put my finger on it yet. But it was clear that like we were in the early stages of changing as a city.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, I moved to Orlando for the same reason. My wife said, that's where I want to live. And I said, yes. Yeah. So, you know, the power of a woman's influence, right? Yeah. So what business did you start building here? Around what time, what year was it?
Do you remember? This was 1999. So the business, when we first started out with this business, the whole premise behind it was websites at that time were mostly being developed by engineers. And so they were incredibly ugly, really bad usability. And I saw an opportunity to focus on high-end design, you know, the user experience, making it something that was more than just something that was informational, but also served a real marketing purpose. So that's what we originally set out to do. And, you know, eventually, so the whole, in the beginning was like, I don't want to have any engineers. I don't want to do any of that stuff. And then eventually it became, you know, the full, a full service developer. And we did everything from CD-ROMs, DVD-ROMs. We built a bunch of our own IP. We had a product called Disk Tracer that would allow us to trace CD-ROMs as they were inserted on a computer and change the content dynamically. Mm-hmm. And we had like a big partnership with Earthlink. So when you put in one of their disks, we'd be able to kind of change the content that you saw based on who you were. We did a lot of really cool things, pioneering, you know, really interactive websites, advert games. We were featured a lot on, you know, I don't know if you guys remember Macromedia Site of the Day. I'm old school, man. This is before Adobe bought Macromedia, but it was a lot of those early web technologies before all, you know, everybody had broadband connectivity and phones. But you know, our early bet was that this was going to change the way that everything was done. And frankly, that's, you know, that was one of the reasons that I shifted paths and decided to sell out of that other company. Was there was a lot of focus on more like traditional media, And while I like that, I like being able to see my work on a billboard or a television commercial, to me there was no doubt that the web was the future, and I wanted to put all my time and effort into web technologies and helping people understand how to use these to their advantage.
And now you're using all of that experience that has been stacked from, you know, slinging t-shirts, working on the first Mac, yeah, to building your own agency, doing major partnerships, to where you are now.
Yeah.
Now talk to us, let's go into the depths of IZEA. You're working with influencers,
yep,
content creators.
Yep.
Give me an idea of maybe an influencer or, you know, content. I don't know if you're allowed to use names and such, but like, give us an idea of the kind of people that you really love to serve.
My favorite type of creator is still, I mean, where we got our start was like the mommy bloggers. I think that there is just something so incredible about helping those moms in particular be able to like pursue their passion, get some additional income, be with their kids. That to me is it's incredibly rewarding. And I think it's become even more rewarding, you know, as I've had my own child. But more generally speaking, I get the most pleasure out of helping kind of the everyday influencer, right? The everyday creator who is not necessarily a celebrity, you know, doesn't have an agent, hasn't already, you know, quote unquote made it, but is trying to make it, right? Those are the stories that, those are the ones that touch my heart. And those are the ones where it's like, you can tell that you're really having an impact on their lives, because, you know, a celebrity may get paid a couple $100,000 for a tweet or for a photo, but to them it's like immaterial, right? And it's almost just kind of like, okay, I'll do it. When you pair up an ordinary influencer with a brand, especially the brand that they love, like, they're thankful for that, you know, and they're excited about it, and it's in so many more ways just a more authentic relationship between both that influencer and the brand and our relationship with them, right? You know, they're just more thankful to have that opportunity. So that to me is why we wake up and do this and you know, deal with all the challenges. You know, that's the reward.
And Ted, this is David talking. And when I think back to, I was fortunate enough to work for you here at IZEA and run the 2007 and 8 time frame. And I listened to you.
Old school. David's old gold.
And I think about those days, and even before I'd followed IZEA, before I joined the team, and the thought in the marketplace around influencer marketing and sponsored conversations has really shifted. I've seen in the past there was a number of people that were thinking that this was a negative thing and that paying people to sponsor content or share brand stories was in some way causing some inauthenticity to their audience. But it seems like nowadays it's become much more adopted. There's a lot of other smaller startups starting around this, and
yep,
it seems like a lot more agencies and companies are now seeing this direction. And the question I have is, you're looked at as the father of sponsored conversations and the father of influencer marketing. And when that challenge happened at the beginning, when you were getting that pushback from places like TechCrunch and a number of other people,
yep,
how did you really drive through that challenge and really help shift that influencer marketing positioning to where it's at today?
I think that one of the challenges you have as an entrepreneur who is creating a new category is that there's going to be incumbents that are embedded in their business model. There's going to be incumbents that are embedded in their way of thinking, and that you pose a threat to. And you have to recognize that there's going to be pushback on whatever you do. you know, for traditional media, of course they would be threatened by something like this, right? Like, it's not just that their entire business model would have to change, which was historically advertising and traditional advertising, just throwing ads and getting CPMs on those ads, but the idea now that the big media outlets have to be able to compete with everybody who's got a cell phone and who can create a piece of content, like, that's scary, right? <Yeah. laughs> they don't want that. They don't want to validate that. Now, instead of, you know, a couple of big media companies competing with each other, now they're competing against a 17-year-old girl sitting in her bedroom making YouTube videos about makeup, right? And those dollars are going to eventually come out of their pocket. They're going to be shifted. They're going to be fragmented. So, of course, they would be against that. I think that what helped me get through that period was being able to focus on what I believed was the future and what I believed was right, and not getting distracted by all of the naysayers and all the people who said it wouldn't work and all the people who said it was going to die and it was a terrible idea. But I'll also tell you that on the other side of that, like, it's hard to be first. It is really hard to be first. And there's a saying that the pioneers get the arrows in the back, right? And it's 100% true. The guys who go first, they're gonna fight the toughest battles. And it's something I talk about with our team a lot too. Is like, don't just jump on something because it's the shiny new object, and because you want to be first in something, and sometimes it actually makes sense to be second or third or fourth, because you let the other people deal with the expenses and the challenges of figuring it out, and then you're able to kind of come in with a better solution. And frankly, in our business, it's been something that's been it frustrates me on the other side, right? Because we did have to fight all the fights, and we did have to deal with, getting the FTC regulations in place, right? And having those discussions and going to Washington. Like, we had to spend a lot of time and money trying to figure stuff out. And if you're a newer company in the space, like, part of the playbook's already been written. You still have a lot of catch up to do, because I think that the pioneer, as long as you can make it through those battles, you do wind up in a better spot. But you don't have the same challenges that the guy who goes first does, right? Like, there's already, you can look ahead and you can see the dirt road that somebody already chopped down a lot of those trees that were in the way. And so I think that there's a story there and there's a lesson there, and that you got to kind of pick where do you want to be the trailblazer, and where do you want to kind of let somebody else go first and figure that out. And it's something that we wrestle with on a constant basis.
Very powerful lesson.
Yeah, that's really great feedback. And then also for the entrepreneurs out there listening, like, the pioneer does catch the majority of the arrows.
Yep.
So a lot of times people have this idea of, like, I've got this brilliant idea, and you probably get thousands of ideas being, CEO and founder of this company and in the position you're in. So you probably get tons of ideas. So let's do a little role play, okay? Yeah. So I'm an entrepreneur, and I'm coming to you with this crazy idea, never been done before. Like, what would be the advice that you give to one of the entrepreneurs out there who have this incredible idea in their mind, at least, right?
Yep.
And their grandmother says it's a great idea. What advice do you have for them? Or what questions do you have for them?
Look, I'm always torn on things like this, right? Because first and foremost, the entrepreneur in me is like, go get it. Like, go make it happen. Go see what's out there. And see what you can do with the minimal resources possible. So even when I look back at my early days as an entrepreneur, it was, I'm always in a mode of like testing, right? So don't go out and be like, hey, I got a great idea to sell a bunch of t-shirts, print all the t-shirts, and then hope you can sell them. If there's a way to just print out a piece of paper, walk it around, and see if you can sell it that way, right? And when we look at things like new product development here, there is some of that mentality still, right? It's like, let's make sure that that there's going to be demand. Let's try to pre-sell this. Let's see if we can get somebody to pay for this feature development, so that we can validate that there is something there. You know, the ideas that are truly radical and different and disruptive, they are also incredibly expensive to actually pursue, right? So when you look at the Airbnbs, you look at the Ubers, even us, right? We're nowhere near the size of those companies, but you know, tens of millions of dollars went into fighting those fights, right? And creating the ecosystem. And you have to realize that those are going to be long, expensive battles. And unless you have the resources to take them on, it's going to be very difficult. And unless you have some sort of proof point, it's also going to be difficult to raise money. So for me, it's like try to figure out as quickly as possible if there is actually a there, right? And then realize that if it's truly as big of an idea as you think it is, it's going to take longer than you ever thought, and it's going to cost more than you ever thought to actually make it a reality and to, you know, to survive creating the category. And creating the category, you also have to have a iron stomach, because you have to realize that everybody and their mother is going to try to take you down. You know, it's like, you look at Uber, it's like the amount of regulation and red tape that they've had to deal with, because there were incumbents, right? There were incumbents that were in that space. Even Airbnb to this day, like the hotels continue to fight that, right? Because it's taking money out of their pocket.
Taxi companies and
right. You know, so you have to realize even things like SpaceX, right? Like you're like, well, there's not a competitor there. Yeah, there is. There's big government, right? Like those are still jobs. That is still money. There is still an entire ecosystem there that is dependent on the way that things were. And it's going to take up, you know, before that is the new norm, it's going to take a lot of money to make it happen.
So Ted, we may have a number of entrepreneurs listening to this show who have this big idea and want to really create something large and disruptive. And like you said, it takes time, it takes money. And you've been fortunate enough to, or had the hustle enough and foresight enough to raise money to really grow and take basically a fragmented marketplace. When we look at Airbnb and Uber and yep. what Isaiah is doing, so many different content creators and trying to aggregate and assemble them to be able to bring them opportunities in a uniform, scalable way. So I guess my question to you would be, what advice would you give other entrepreneurs who are trying to raise money here in Orlando from somebody who's actually been able to do it and stay here in Orlando and grow here in Orlando?
So it's interesting because Orlando is not the best place to raise money, right? There's no doubt about it. It is a very small. There's a small group of funds, you know, and they're not big funds by any means. But it is
to me, I have never looked at Orlando as a geographic restriction for where I can look for money. So my, you know, my money has come out of California, it's come out of New York, it's come out of all over, all across the country. Just because I live in Orlando doesn't mean I need to raise money from a fund that's in Orlando. The bigger challenge that you will face if you're successful in raising that outside money is staying in Orlando. And, you know, the idea that a lot of the investors that are in those larger markets have that says like, oh, well, I now need you to move to New York, or I need you to move to the Valley because I need to have you here. I need to be able to check in on you.
Angels don't fly.
Yeah. So to speak. But the advantages of being in Orlando, I think, outweigh the advantages of being in those larger cities, specifically when you are small and when every single dollar matters. Because, you know, we look at companies all the time on an M&A front, and it's the people that are in Silicon Valley, like, their cost for engineering is 2.5x ours. Mm-hmm. And it's not, and the engineers are not 2.5x better.
Just the premiums tacked on because they're in Silicon Valley,
right,
so to speak.
And it all flows down from the cost of living and everything else. And so their OPEX, their burn, is just naturally higher. And that inflates everything. That inflates what they need to be able to do their initial funding at, you know, what valuation. It affects how much money they have to raise. It expects what, you know, what the next round has to be. And so you have all these inflated expectations that unless you like hit a grand slam home run, nobody's making any money. The entrepreneur's not making any money, mm-hmm, at the end of the day, because you have all these liquidation preferences that are being put into place by the investors. And it's because of the capital requirements. It's because how expensive it is to build a company in New York. It's because how expensive it is to build a company in Silicon Valley. And at a time when you are so strapped for cash, it just doesn't make sense. And it still doesn't, even us, you know, we're 12 years old. It's like, I don't want to be in Silicon Valley. I don't want to be in New York. I have salespeople there. They work in WeWorks, right? Like, I would never relocate my core operations there, because everything just becomes more expensive, and it's not giving you access to demonstrably better talent, mm-hmm, especially on the engineering side. You know, it's like if you are a top tier engineer, you're not going to work for a startup that just raised a couple million bucks. It's just not, unless it's your startup, right? Unless you are the engineer and you were like a founder and you were going to get a meaningful chunk, you're the little guy who's fighting for the scraps from, you know, the Googles, the Facebooks, and everybody else in Silicon Valley. And same thing in New York, right? Like, the big guys are going to be able to always pay a premium, and that's where the majority of that best, the highest end talent is going to go. So I look at it here in being in Orlando, and I say we have access to a phenomenal university system that turns out great engineers. We have all the companies, you know, the aerospace companies that are around here that also turn out great engineers who do look for change and look for different opportunities. The cost per living is low here. The quality of life is great here. This city just continues to become a better and better city to live in. You know, the nightlife is like, there's actual real nightlife now. There's great entertainment. We got sports. Like, it's a great place to live. And I know that, you know, my team members who live here, who are able to own a house with a pool, have kids, live a comfortable lifestyle in one of those other cities, they would, you know, they'd be living in a 600 square foot apartment.
Sure. you know? And so like my people are happier, it costs me less. And like, if you haven't figured out how to do business globally from anywhere, like, then you're not getting it anyway. It shouldn't matter. Like, if you're real, especially if you want to be in a tech company, like, you need to be able to do business anywhere. You can't be geographically confined. So it's like, get the investors from outside Orlando. If you can get some inside Orlando too, great. But don't just say, hey, I'm only, because I live in Orlando, I'm gonna go after Orlando investors. That's crazy. Mm-hmm. Identify with investors who think in the same way too. Steve Case has a great book called The Third Wave, and he actually talks about how companies are moving outside of the major tech hubs and how all this is getting disrupted. And there are investors out there who are like, yeah, why would you do that in Silicon Valley? It's like way more expensive to do that there. Like, go to some place where it costs less, right?
There was an article last month that talked about the exodus, and it said that the headline was Silicon Valley is over from Silicon Valley. And they're traveling and they're looking for new places, especially in the Midwest. And to your point, I think Orlando has this great opportunity to attract this outside capital where investors can get better valuations in companies, yep. Be able to really scale and grow that. And so, and that would really help our ecosystem to become more abundant, more thriving. When you have more exits, you have more angel investors, you have more, if engineers exited, maybe they become the next founders. When you look at the PayPal mafia, that's what happened in Silicon Valley. So we're all in this movement, yourself included and our team, and many people across the ecosystem, to try to create an abundant entrepreneurial ecosystem here. And I think it starts with a lot of the things that you brought up and attracting outside capital and growing here.
And I mean, you look at platforms like AngelList, like those people could be anywhere in the world. And they're not investing in you because of your geography. They're investing in you because of your team and because of your idea. And so it's like a lot of people like to look at Orlando's lack of venture funds or angel investors as like, that's what's holding me back. I need to go someplace else. It's bullshit. Like, it's complete bullshit. You need to change the way that you're thinking. You need to change the way that you're going at the market. You need to change the way that you're identifying investors, because that shouldn't inhibit you. If you have a great idea, that should not inhibit you.
So you're here in Orlando, you started here in Orlando, and I don't know if you're able to share this, but how much money have you raised for your company that's based in Orlando?
Just under $50 million.
So you've raised just under $50 million. And so this is one of those marks that entrepreneurs who are using that as the scapegoat have to think to themselves and say, if he could raise $50 million in this market, well, granted it was from outside places, but stay here in Orlando and grow here in Orlando, I can too.
Yeah, there's no excuse. And I've always applied that to even, my previous business was like, we were in Orlando, but we never went after customers in Orlando. I used the fact that we were in Orlando as a competitive advantage to say, look, you're paying an agency in New York $250 an hour to provide these services. I'll do it for $150. And I still had better margins than the guys that were charging $250, right? So do not let that be the excuse or the crutch. It may take some investment and some travel to go out and find those other investors, but if you're just looking within a 50-mile square radius of your house, like, that's crazy to me. And if an entrepreneur ever came to me and was like, I can't raise money because I'm in Orlando, I'm like, you're not an entrepreneur that I'm gonna back, because you're just so limited in your thinking at that point. How are you going to build a global company if you can't figure out how to raise money from investors outside of Orlando? how are you going to deal with a distributed team where, you know, people want to work in locations all over the country. People want to be able to travel. People want to be able to, you know, video conference. And how are you going to do that if you can't, you know, look outside of your own zip code to raise funds?
Yeah, very true.
That's powerful. There's a lot of wisdom packed into this, and you can tell from, you know, being in the place you're at. Circling around to the company here, we're sitting here in your headquarters in Orlando, Florida, and tell us a little bit now, get into some weeds of how do you serve influencers and brands so we can paint a picture for what your company does, because I mean, you have an incredible amount of experience, you've raised a good amount of capital, you're really serving people out there. We could tell what ignites your heart on fire when you create some success stories. So kind of tell us how you do that. So yep. If someone's out there listening, they go, oh, that's me, and I could use you for a service.
Yeah, so we have a couple online marketplaces that we operate. Our primary one is called IZEAX. And on the creator side, they come in, they sign up, they add their social channels, they can basically build out a content portfolio, and that makes them available to the marketers and brands who are in our marketplace. So it creates their profile, if you will. Our platform allows the brands to come in and create what we call an opportunity. And think of that like the combination between a creative brief and a casting call. And they can put that out to our system and basically say, I want people who meet this criteria using these filters to be able to see this opportunity. And then basically the creators on the other side, they'll raise their hand and say, oh, you know what, I want to work on that Starbucks campaign, and I'm willing to do it for X dollars, and here's why I'm a good match for you, Starbucks. And basically the software manages that whole negotiation process. It manages the content creation process, the content review process, the analytics, and then ultimately facilitates payment back to that creator. So we have really two models that we work in. One is what we call a managed service model, where we're managing our software for our customers, and they get basically like an enterprise view into that, where it's very light touch if they don't have the resources in-house to do it themselves. And then we also license the platform to ad agencies, PR firms, and then the brands direct. So, you know, as the brands get more sophisticated, we believe that more and more of them are going to just want to be able to use software and not have the managed service component, which we have to charge for because we have people doing it. You know, we just want to be able to sell them the software and let them use the software to manage those campaigns.
Now, you made some really awesome points about how back in the day, if someone wanted to create influencer marketing or brand positioning, they would pay a celebrity.
Yep.
And these big brands, these big agencies would manage these contracts. And now someone with a cell phone could create this content and get 17 million views on, you know, LinkedIn or Twitter or Facebook or YouTube or yep, whatever the case may be. So it's really causing a great opportunity for creators. So what kind of creators are you looking for to be a part of your community and that you can really serve? What kind of, give me some ideas of what they look like.
Yeah, I mean, I will say that things have certainly changed over time. More and more of the emphasis is being put on the content quality itself, as opposed to just the reach of a creator. So in the early days of influencer marketing, a lot of people were very, very fixated on the amount of followers and you know, the engagement, and those are still core metrics. But what we're seeing in the influencer space is that content is at least as important, if not more than important than those metrics now. And so the ability for someone to produce a really good looking video or write a really good blog post and not have it
I had the blog be all cluttered up with ads and look nasty. Those are things that advertisers are really looking for now, because they are taking a lot of that content now and they're repurposing it. So if someone does, something, duct tape is one of our clients, for example. You know, someone makes something really cool out of duct tape, and they post it to their Instagram. Duct tape will want to use that and post it to their own Instagram and give credit back to that creator. But it serves a need for duct tape in that if they were going to hire an agency to produce this type of content, there'd be a creative director, there'd be a photographer, there'd be some sort of licensing or rights that were associated, there would be the account management, there would be like all these additional costs that go into creating a single piece of content so that they have something to share on their social channel. With influencer marketing, they get kind of the best of both worlds. They get the exposure to the initial audience, they get any sort of engagement that comes from that, but then they also get this cool piece of content that they can use for their own channels or for, you know, like we have customers that will take stuff from a blog campaign, for example, and they'll take the photos, like let's say it's recipes, right? They'll take the photos, the recipes, they'll use them in their email newsletters, they'll use them on their site, they'll use them on their Facebook. We've had customers that have created completely new websites just to house the content that was produced from an influencer campaign, because you know they see it as a new way to connect with their audience. So people get, I think from an influencer standpoint, they still get very fixated on the numbers. Mm-hmm. But we also have to realize, like, as the algorithms have changed on the social networks, like, yeah, you got 100,000 followers, but you're reaching, 1.5% of that.
Yeah. That's true.
So what happens on the other side of that is that the brand says, oh, that's a really great piece of content. Let me put paid dollars behind it. But if it's a crappy piece of content, they're not going to, they don't want to put extra dollars behind it.
Yeah.
So the ones that we are seeing today are, and this is actually, I think, a good thing for the micro influencers, right? The people that are like super passionate or creating awesome content, but may just not be a good marketer, right? Because the people that have the big audiences, they are good at creating content, but they're also really good at marketing themselves, mm-hmm. right? But we see people all the time that they produce good content, they're just not like, they're not great at marketing themselves. They don't get how all those things go together. So I think it creates a lot of opportunities for people that may not be a great marketer, but do create really good content and are really passionate about skateboards or watches or beaches or whatever it may be. They have an opportunity.
That's amazing how many niches there are on the internet. I mean, that you could do, I mean, drones and, you know, fishing or whatever.
Yeah.
Have you, any amount of influencers could be served through your platform, and any content creators could, you know, contribute.
Yep.
And that's wonderful. So it's been a wonderful, wonderful interview. I do want to ask before we kind of wrap up, the one thing, there's a lot of things I admire and respect about you, but the culture that you've built here at IZEA was something I think is so unique and so special that if we didn't ask about it on this podcast, I think we would be doing a disservice to our listeners. So can you talk a little bit about the culture you've created here and tried to maintain? I mean, there's bright colors everywhere and there's a bar in here. And, you know, when I worked here, I know we rang in new hires with tequila shots.
Yeah.
Over 21.
Yeah,
over
HR 21. Doesn't really. You
know, and cake plows, all that stuff. But can you talk about
those
that?
Those were the good old days when you were allowed to do stuff like that. You know, I culture is incredibly important to me, and you know, culture is really people, right? And it's about making sure that you hire the right people, that you are united in your mission, you are united in your values, and the things that are important to you. And you know, when you look around this place, it's like a lot of the people here are, you know, they're not the people that have graduated from the MITs or the Harvards, right? Nor did I. But they are the scrappers. You know, they are the people that are passionate about what they do. They are the workhorses. They, you know, people here, they put in a tremendous amount of hours, but it's not because anybody is telling them to put in a tremendous amount of hours. You know, it is because they are committed and they are dedicated to what they are doing. And so, you know, it's like when we are looking at hiring somebody, it is not about where they went to school or what their GPA was. It's, you know, understanding, do they have the right cultural values? Do they have, do we believe that they have the right instincts, you know, for how they're going to deal with challenges? That to me is, that's what makes the organization. Because, you know, look, we've had a lot of those arrows in our backs, right? Like, and we're constantly fighting uphill battles. And I think every company deals with that. And if you don't have the right people on board, you wind up losing your people as you deal with those things, right? But, you know, I look around at some of the, I mean, some of the people that work here were interns for me at my last company. I mean, we've been working together for 16 years, right? Like, that's crazy. Actually, oh my gosh, even more than that, like since 99. I mean, that to me just tells me that, like, you're doing something right. You're always going to have your challenges and do things wrong, but, like, you have people that stick with you through all the challenges, and they're still there by your side. It's you're building something right at the core, and the people are the most important part of any business. You know, for all the investment we make in technology and everything else, and try to automate things, it's like if you don't have the people at the end of the day, everything else falls apart.
Yeah, that's awesome. And you could see that when we walked in, people were smiling, super friendly, people were hanging out, and it's just, it feels like a good environment. Now, you've created, as we wrap this up, I really want people to understand how they can connect with you and your brand and your company here. So you've created a multi-sided marketplace, right? Where you serve creators, they're creating content, and you help them monetize their art, you help them create opportunities for themselves, and you're really giving them an ability to do what they love to do. On the other side of the marketplace, you're helping brands connect with incredible influencers, creators of art, creators of content, and they're using it for many different ways. Could you give us maybe a few examples of the brands and even agencies that you mentioned? Could you give us a few examples of those kind of companies that could really benefit from working with you guys?
Yep. I mean, our historical focus has been on very large brands. So again, going back to that idea of, like, we don't actually have a lot of customers here in Orlando. You know, Amazon's a client, Walmart's a client, Nationwide Insurance is a client, Hertz is a client. We do their influencer marketing campaigns. We do custom content for them. You know, we will power their blog. Those are, and a lot of those campaigns are, like, wrapped together too. So we're producing content on their blog, then we're using influencers to promote the content on their blog. At the same time, we work with agencies, PR firms, and those people will either use our services or we will license our platform to them. So that, you know, our win at the end of the day and what we're trying to accomplish is, you know, we want to help partner with a lot of those agencies. We want to show them how to do what we do, and then we want to give them the software to do it themselves and to build their own business on top of this and to make themselves more efficient, right? Because the crazy thing about the business that we are in is it's not that you couldn't do it yourself, right? You could go out and create content, or you could find freelancers to create content. You could find influencers to do a campaign for you. but we're providing all the workflow, the management, the scale, the measurement to make it better, right? So it's it in that way, it's we're solving the same type of a problem that like an Airbnb would, right? You know, it's like, it's not that you couldn't find a place to rent or that you couldn't go to like a Craigslist, right? But like, there's a lot of things that are kind of sketchy about that, right? And you know, how do you pay the person? How do you know that it's a quality place? How do you know that the pictures online are representative of what you're gonna get? And that's kind of our same role here too, is like make it a better experience, make it easier, we're helping both the buyer and the seller, right? That to us is our role in all of this, and that's our win, and we want to be able to scale that out because we believe that the more opportunity that we can bring to our creators, the more liquidity in the marketplace, that's our end game, right? Like, we want them to earn more money. We want more money in their pocket, and to the extent that we can partner with agencies and PR firms to create more of that liquidity and have them put more of their opportunities through our system, that's the win.
Awesome. Well, Ted, I know David and I really appreciate you
sitting
with us and chatting. So if I'm a influencer out there or a brand or even an agency looking to partner to find out more information on influencer marketing and using your software to grow their side of the business, how could people find you, find your company? Where could people go to find us?
Yep, just go to izea.com, IZEA.com, and you can sign up right there for the platform or request a demo if you're an agency or brand. I'm on Twitter at Ted Murphy, Instagram at Ted Murphy, Facebook/Ted Murphy. Just Google Ted Murphy.
Awesome. Well, thank you for welcoming us here at IZEA and just for being a great Orlando entrepreneur. Ladies and gentlemen listening into this audience and listening into this show, just want to thank you for, you know, your patronage and for being a part of our community here as we come together and lift up Orlando as a place to build, but more importantly, lifting up the people who are building here in Orlando. So just want to say thank you from the bottom of my heart and from our team. We hope you have a wonderful day, and we will talk with you and speak with you on the next episode. Goodbye, everyone.
Thank you for listening in on today's episode. If you would like to be a guest on the show or start up a conversation with me, Josh, your host, send me an email to josh@orlandoentrepreneurs.org. You can also find out more information on Orlando's entrepreneurial ecosystem, discover resources to help you start and grow your business, and subscribe to future shows by visiting www.orlandoentrepreneurs.org.